And welcome to the How to Be Good podcast. This week, without doubt, we had a couple of issues with the podcast. It seems that our platform decided to go a little bit pear-shaped. But having said that, we've listened to it and we've had a think, and we still think it's worth sharing, as much as the audio and the video aren't as clear as we would normally like. But the interviews that we had with Duncan Ward, who is the founder of Classroom of Hope, and also on the show at the same time was Marcus Silverberg, who is the founder of Block Solutions. And they're both working together to build schools, not just schools everywhere. These are schools in places that desperately need them. Places that have been hit by disaster, that have economic issues, that can't just hand out the money at this stage to be able to get these schools built and for the needed education of these children. Mm.
Indeed. And the interview was so great. We really enjoyed getting to know Duncan and Marcus. We didn't want to miss the chance of giving you the natural version of the interview rather than repeating it and getting the information straight from them with regards to the amazing work that they're doing. They're changing kids' lives. They're completely changing their trajectory, and it's impressive.
Yeah, and it was kind of an interview of two halves within one interview.
Yeah,
I think there was the first section, it was rounded between the two, but there wasn't a specific section, should I say?
Yeah.
But we were talking both to Duncan, who obviously founded Classroom of Hope, and the amazing things that they're doing and achieving there, and the number of schools they've managed to build as well. But then also talking to Marcus about his invention of these blocks that helps them do that, that helps them facilitate it, and also helps these schools be built efficiently, much quicker than anywhere else that we've seen so far.
Sustainable, and
that's right, as well.
Carbon neutral as well, which is impressive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So let's get on with it. Let's listen. We're sorry the quality isn't as good as we would normally like. But as Anka said, it would be a shame to try and redo it and not have the natural tone of the interview that we did. So let's get to it and listen to the show. So, Duncan, could you tell us a little bit about you and what led you to founding Classroom of Hope and what you were doing before then?
Sure, no problems. I'll give you the short version because I can carry on a little bit about it. But prior to founding Classroom of Hope, I worked as a management consultant, and my trade was network engineering. And I worked across the globe for multiple large major corporations. And so I spent most of my time working in the corporate world. In 2008, my brother passed away tragically. And I just started reviewing my life and started asking myself some important questions. What am I doing for other human beings, and what am I doing for the planet? And at that point in my life, I wasn't doing anything. So I was a little bit disappointed in myself, and that led me on a trip around the world where I traveled through Africa, through Asia, through South America, many countries across the globe. And on that trip, I kind of set an intention for myself of finding a bit more purpose and meaning on how I could give back to our planets and how I can give back to societies. Along those journeys, I traveled through Cambodia. I met this incredibly inspiring man named Raki. You can find his name in The Lonely Planet, for those who read The Lonely Planet these days. And he took me around and showed me what happened there in Cambodia from the Pol Pot regime in the 70s and how many, many schools were destroyed there. And I asked him to take me and show me these schools. And I asked him what his dream was for these communities. And he said his dream was to redevelop all of these schools, to get them back up with better infrastructure, to get the kids into access to better quality education. And he had a small little NGO that he had set up there, and it required some support. So In my search for a bit more meaning, I met this man and I promised him that I'd come back and help him rebuild all of these 13 schools that were destroyed. And that led me on a discovery on how to set up a charity or a not-for-profit organization. Classroom of Hope was born out of that promise that I made to that man, who's now one of my dearest friends, and I hold him very close to my heart. Since that point in time, we formed a partnership, and in 2017, we had rebuilt all of those 12 or 13 schools in that region. And he's running an amazing organization, local NGO, and he's changing communities over there. To me, he's a big hero, unsung heroes that are doing good work in rural communities. So that's how Classroom of Hope started. It started off with a project, and along that journey, I met my wife. She's a co-founder and our creative director, Nicola. She's Canadian. And she and I both learned about the global education crisis. You know, 250 million children globally can't read or write. 161 million children primary and secondary age don't have access to education. And the shortage of classrooms across sub-Saharan Asia was significant. So we both realized that this wasn't just about a project and, you know, honoring a man's dream. This is now becoming about purpose for us and about really giving back and creating a footprint of impact and a legacy that we can leave behind and we can showcase to our own children. I saw what the value of education did for myself. I'm originally from South Africa. I immigrated to Australia, and my education got me into that country and allowed me to travel the world, and it unlocked and opened up significant opportunities for myself. So the same with my wife, and her studies. So we love kids. We love what kids stand for, and it should be a human right for every child to get access to an education. So anything we can do to get kids back into school is what we do. So that's how it all started. I left my corporate job. We were obviously working our corporate jobs and in the charity part-time, trying to scale and build the organization, trying to understand how do we build this thing and set it up for success sustainably. It wasn't easy, and it came with a lot of challenges. So we're now coming up to 9 years since we started the organization, and it's been incredible learning and humbling journey. So we left our corporate jobs and went full-time into Classroom of Hope. And since then, we've developed 74 schools, 75 now, serving just over 21,000 kids in rural communities of Africa and Asia. And we still have a lot more to do.
Fantastic, fantastic. So when was it that you managed to transition from your corporate career to full-time not-for-profit?
That was 3 years after starting Classroom of Hope. We weren't earning anything for the first 3 years, and we were working multiple jobs in Australia, and we were reaching a point of burnout, and we had to take a leap of faith. And, our operating budget back then was so small. I don't have a problem telling anybody, I've seen my first salary I was earning was $18,000 a year. With the organization when I started it. And we always knew it was going to be a journey of scaling with the organization and growing with the organization. It was never about the money, otherwise I would have stayed in my corporate role. So that was the transition. And we ended up shifting and moving from Australia and traveling between Australia and Indonesia to manage our costs as well, keep our costs down. And because a lot of our programs were in this region.
Fantastic. It's nice to hear how people have transitioned. A lot of people sort of look at it with sort of almost rose-tinted glasses. We went to that and we got a charity and we run it. It takes time and effort and dedication. And yeah, hats off to you.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about the sustainable development goals? You target 11 out of the 17 UN Global Sustainable Development Goals. Number.
Prior, we've been building bricks and mortar schools in Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and Rwanda with our local partners. And if you look at the UN SDGs based on that kind of product that we're using, we're probably only touching a couple of them. You know, quality education, clean water and sanitation if we're building infrastructure, maybe three, and no poverty because education helps fight poverty. However, the new product and the more resilient schools that we're now looking at, and this is the future of schools and homes, is the product from Block Solutions, where we're able to build with recycled plastic. So when you start looking at that and how the impact curve goes up when it comes to the environment, to climate control, to life below the water, I'm trying to think of them all now, but off the top of my head, you know, number one, no poverty, three, good health and well-being, six, clean water and sanitation, number eight, decent work and economic growth because you're providing jobs, number nine, a big one, industry, innovation and infrastructure, sustainable cities and communities, responsible consumption and production, climate change, and life below the water. So because
I must say, first, I'm very impressed that you managed to reel off those.
I don't even know, but I've probably got some of the numbers wrong there. But
you got them there. Awesome.
I've looked at them so many times, but to me, you know, that's what we're trying to do. Is those UN SDGs is about bringing the world back into balance. And to bring the world back into balance, we need to focus on those areas and to come across an extraordinary product that Marcus invented and his team at Block Solutions are sharing with the world, mm-hmm. to me is an absolute game changer, especially in the international development space.
We are very interested in the product. We're both architects, and we're actually rebuilding our house. So
as well as lots of other people's.
And we were thinking, we can use the blocks. They're so quick. We could just finish it really quickly ourselves. So, yeah, we have lots of questions coming your way, Marcus.
Okay.
In the meantime, I wanted to ask, do you get any help from local governments when you're building the schools?
Yes, we do. We do. Our development approach is very much about what I call smartnerships. It has to be a collaborative process. And you have to bring the government on the journey. You have to bring the local communities on the journey. We work with local governments, federal, across all the countries. And the reason why we do that is because it can't just be a handout. So I'll give you one example. So if we're going to go and build a school in rural Cambodia, our local partner will go to that community, do the assessments, ensure it meets the criteria, and then they will do a presentation to all of the local communities and the local leaders, as well as the local government and federal government. If they are satisfied that they are empowered, then they will sign contracts with us where the community will provide the land and the foundation on the land, as well as a fence around to keep animals out for that school. That will be their contribution. And sometimes it normally works out to about $1 per household that they're contributing to that. Secondly, the government will sign contracts to provide teachers and salaries to the ratio of roughly about 35 students per teacher. And once we know that they have signed on the paper with us, then everybody's on the journey. We're all in this together. And then we will provide the actual capital and the funding to build the school, build clean water facilities, build toilets, the actual infrastructure that's required for children to have a safe and secure learning environment. And at the end of that school building process, once it's completed, we'll have a ceremony and there'll be a handover process where we'll hand that school over to the government and the local communities, and it will be their school that they will monitor and evaluate. We still have a framework to monitor and evaluate it to ensure it's maintaining those levels of standards moving forward. But you know, to us, the school's the output, the outcome, the kids graduating and getting educated. Working with governments is, I think, is important because in the long run, it can't just be reliant on NGO level of reform that needs to occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. So how many, I think you mentioned earlier, was it 70-something schools you've built already?
Yeah, 75 schools now, serving just over 21,000 kids across Rwanda, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar, and Indonesia.
That's an impressive number, especially considering, like, just locally here, trying to get a school from idea to site and completion, you're probably looking at around 7 years here. So it's crazy timescale.
Yeah.
That's a very, very impressive number.
Thank you. We've got a great team and great partners. Everybody's works hard towards the same mission, which is great.
Fantastic. And what were the countries again that you did them in? So Myanmar was one of them, and Cambodia, yes. Rwanda,
Laos, or some say Laos, and Indonesia. After the earthquakes happened here, we started building in Lombok. So we have quite a huge pipeline to build there in Lombok for all the schools that were destroyed by the earthquakes.
Yeah, and are those generally your target areas, or you'll go globally where you're needed to go depending on what happens?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have always been building with bricks and mortar, and depending on supply and demand and how bad the problem of plastic is in those specific countries, you know, my vision is, you know, Indonesia is just the beginning in terms of building with EcoBlocks, Block Solutions product, and scaling that product across Southeast Asia, Asia, Asia Pacific, and the globe is really important. So, you know, I'm already talking to our partners in these other regions about what's going on here in Indonesia and how this can be leveraged and shared across their regions as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we spoke to a chap a while ago from Repurpose Global, and they pull in plastic from the oceans and everything, all in similar kind of areas and things like that. Mm-hmm. And then they help people reuse, recycle, repurpose that plastics and things like that. And we just kind of thought that there's a great opportunity. Obviously, I don't know the details of how you build a box, and Marcus will help with that in a sec, hopefully. But it's just all of a sudden we can all work together to come to one final goal that's overall better for the planet. Yes. And people and everybody. And I just love the idea of it.
Yeah. It's an absolute no-brainer, you know, when it comes to using these new blocks. Just looking at Lombok, for example, you know, by building with those blocks, you know, rather than us building permanent structures that will fall over again because of the earthquakes, these are earthquake resistant, you know, so kids are going to be that much more safer, and they last 100+ years. I mean, that's what they can test up until, right, Marcus, you know, but we all know plastic takes at least 400 or 500 years to degrade. So we're talking about longevity, and then unfortunately, yeah. And then you look at, like, you know, the value proposition to the governments as well is, you know, for standard issue government school cost about 14,000 US across Southeast Asia and Indonesia, and you can build a whole classroom for 7,000 or 8,000 US dollars, and you're building it from recycled plastic waste, and it's taking 5 to 6 days for a 5-classroom school versus 3 to 6 months. So you start doing the economics around that, is it's significant value that's being delivered in return, let alone the environmental impact.
Absolutely. So as we're moving on, we're talking quite well about the blocks. Maybe Marcus, could you tell us a little bit about your journey? What were you doing before, and how you then came up with, I've got this idea to build blocks out of plastic to solve an issue?
Sure. Actually, I'm an inventor. Then I'm a serial entrepreneur. So the thing is, I've been working the whole of my life in let's say, doing something new, something, figuring out how to do things better. I was working for the industry before. I was working for an injection molding factory, actually a very big one in Europe, the biggest one, actually. And I was like a C-level executive over there, responsible for the sales in the whole of Europe. And I sold my company actually to that company. But then I was obliged to stay over there to stay working for the company. And during that time, I was invited by the United Nations to come up with solution after the Haiti crisis, to come up with a solution to build houses easily, which could be dismantled, or they could be transformed into permanent buildings. And they need to be lightweight and without any tools to build it. Okay, how do you do that? So we were actually producing in that company, we were producing these kind of storm boxes to store water in the case of flooding, to store water below the soil. And then I came actually up with this idea to, if they can withstand the load bearing of 60 metric tons per square meter over there below soil, I said they must be doing that same above soil. And then, of course, when I'm from the Nordics, so we have Lego over there, and then we have IKEA for simplicity and so on. And of course, combine those two things, making a finished product called the blocks. And that was really the idea. I actually presented this solution to our our management over there in the big company over there, but they said, hey, come on, this is too disruptive for us. We cannot, we are making also bricks and mortar in the company. So no, nothing for you. And at that point, actually, the time was due for me to leave the company. I was almost already with the 3-year, let's say, compulsory time with the company. I said, hey, come on, guys, if you don't like me to stay over here or let's say to take the product for further development, if it's okay, I will take the product. I've invented the product. So I will start, let's say, developing this thing forward. They said, okay, just don't come to Europe within the 5 next years. That's what they said. I said, okay, I will focus first on Africa because the need is the biggest over there in Africa for that. They really need the affordable houses over there. And let's say that's where it started. We started first with 3D printing. Okay, that was really nothing for us. It is so slow compared to injection molding, what I was, familiar with. And then when I understood that one, 3D printing one of those blocks will take 19 hours. When you injection mold the same block with the, of the same size, it takes 1 minute. So there you could see really the scalability over there, and the need was so huge over there. 50 million units just alone in Africa of houses to be built. We will never be able to cope with anything. And I am very, very value-driven. The thing is, actually, Block Solutions was founding in the same year of the Sustainable Development Goals by United Nations. And we really want to make a change. We want to make an impact. We want to change the lives of people. And that's where we wanted to have the make the big, big, big difference over there, involving the local community to participate in the waste management, let them be a part of that whole process, so they will even actually respect what they're getting. And that was the aim.
So can you tell us a little bit more about the product? So I'm assuming, are you sourcing locally, manufacturing locally and producing? How does that work? And what is the product composed of? Is it just the block? Do you have insulation? Is it fireproof? Just give us a little bit of a...
Yeah, sure.
So we can use it on our house.
Actually, we want it to be as sustainable and environmentally friendly as possible. So let's say from my previous year when we were producing pipes, and let's say we were, for example, producing 3 meter in diameter pipes, and they were transported from, they were like the length of 600 meters long, these pipes. And they were transported from Norway to Saudi Arabia. I said, come on, guys, can that be sustainable? And that's where I said, hey, come on, you have to start thinking differently. And that's when I said, let's make our own decisions about those. Take the production over there where it's local. We have a lot of plastic waste. 90% of the global, plastic waste is going to landfills. So we have that material available. So why don't we utilize that material, train the people on how to operate the factories, transport the factory over there, and then start the production over there, because that is sustainability in my perspective. Local job creation and using the local raw materials and involving the local community to take the plastics away from the nature. So that was, I'm a little bit passionate about this, but that's how it is. But we need to make the change over there. 39% of the carbon emissions in the world are related to construction. So when you think about having a carbon neutral or even a carbon negative product, that's a game changing thing, which I want to. I want to have the winters here in Finland. It's not going to happen during my lifetime anymore, but maybe my kids will have the winters back, that it's minus 30 degrees here in Finland. But the thing is, I want to get it, the place should be better than when we leave this earth, so it would be better for the oncoming generations. Still, what was the more questions about that you were asking about?
It was about the block itself and how it's built. Yeah.
So as it is, it's a load-bearing structure as it is already. So it has a load-bearing capacity of 6.51 megapascals. Will that tell anything else to others than engineers? No, it won't. But let's say to comparison, the cinder block that you have, that has a load-bearing capacity of 3 megapascals. So actually, our blocks have a 2.2 times higher load-bearing capacity than the concrete cinder block. So that gives you a way that it is really pretty good, actually. So we can make small structures with the blocks as it is. Why is it so strong? I took the elements from nature when I started to design the whole block itself. So the honeycomb structure that we have inside the block is making the strength for the load bearing. And then the unique design will enable that you can, for example, install electrical cables easily, just drop the line over there and just drill a hole with a normal wooden drill. And you can insert, for example, a switch or socket inside a structure easily. And also, like Duncan must already know, that it takes about 3 minutes to build 1 square meter wall with the blocks. And one of those big things also there is that Duncan has already also understood that there are no bad days when you're building with the blocks. The biggest block that we are having has a weight of about 3 kilograms. It's lightweight. And the thing is, you cannot do other than 90 degree angles with the structure in that sense. So if you have a bad day, let's say they've been partying out, the bricklayers haven't been partying out, and the next day they're trying to do the finishing over there and it's not looking so good. I used to be actually, supervisor for construction. And I already could see it's always on the Thursday mornings or the Monday mornings when they're not doing the best possible work that they can do. And especially in African countries that, sorry to say, but the quality is not what you expect. So it's better that we force them to do it the right way.
So what type of plastics are used in the manufacturing the block? Are we talking about soft plastics, hard plastics, a mix?
Yeah. The thing is, we're really looking forward to have the recycled plastics everywhere where we can. So using recycled polypropylene, recycled polyethylene, and even the PET plastic, so with the plastic bottles can be recycled into that. We were actually pretty happy to see that we could injection mold PET plastics and that with to the satisfaction that we needed. Usually you do not injection mold PET plastics, but we actually made some modifications to the molds so we could do that. And then actually the ultimate goal for us to establish is to have a super factory that will create this biocomposite, which is actually a mixture of natural fibers like sugarcane, bamboo, coconuts, whatever, to mix that with the plastics. So 50% of fibers, 50% of plastics, mixing that together, compounding it, and then using that for that. That's when we get a product that is carbon negative, binding carbon instead of producing carbon.
Like this one here?
Yeah. That's the one, yeah.
That's so good. Here's one I prepared earlier.
but that is really a carbon negative product. Because otherwise you would be burning those fibers. And that, of course, is creating a lot of, let's say, carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And we really would like to get that away from happening.
That's right, yeah. Because there's a lot in wood pulp and things like that ends up being burnt and stuff. And that again, I guess, is a similar product that could be used as well into that mixed plastic and vegetative materials.
Yeah. But that is really originating from the Nordic countries, or in Canada, you would have that kind of same situation over there where there's a lot of wood industry. Because the thing is really utilizing waste to value. That's what we should be focusing on. We're just over-consuming all the time. Maybe start thinking a little bit differently. That would create something good for all of us. But let's say it takes courage to do that.
Absolutely. So what you mentioned you've done projects in Africa and things like that. What other projects with these blocks have you been doing outside of Classroom of Hope?
So we have, let's say, similar kind of project going on where they're not building, let's say, classrooms. But for example, like Duncan said about Rwanda, they built 4,000 schools just a few years ago over there. And they would still like to build some new schools over there. So that's where we're getting a new factory to Rwanda, for example. The same situation is happening in Ghana, Nigeria, Egypt, Kenya, Uganda. And actually, there are some now activities going forward to Brazil and to Cuba and to Mexico. So we all have partners over there similar to let's say, Classroom of Hope, and who believe that there is a need for that. Then let's say the projects are very, very big. And actually, it was the Classroom of Hope that sparkled the whole thing. We had an exhibition 2 weeks ago in Cairo, where we were actually having the biggest exhibition for construction over there. And we had the smallest booth over there, maybe 12 square meters inside. But all the people were queuing just to get inside the Block Solutions booth. And when we showed the video, the six-day video of in a time-lapse video, when we're building a 300-square-meter school, they were like, come on, hey, we're just wasting our time at the other booths. We want to go for this. And, of course, that's good. People need to get aware.
Absolutely.
So how can you see the Block Solution benefiting globally apart from schools? Are there, I'm assuming, disaster areas? Are there any other areas where you think that this could massively benefit?
Absolutely. When you think about that 1 square meter wall built with the blocks, the weight is about 23 kilograms. So let's take a comparison, a partitioning wall, let's say in a high-rise building. The weight for a normal brick and mortar wall is about 200 kilograms. So we have about 90% less weight, for example, in a structure, which is cutting down the biggest, let's say, consumer of or producing of carbon emissions is actually the concrete and cement industry. So instead of using that kind of course, we do plaster the surface with cement-based products, but still cutting down the weight a lot and then letting people to do the work in 3 minutes instead of 3 hours. So there's a huge, actually, demand for that. For example, in Egypt, they are going to refurbish 14,000 villages in just alone in Egypt in the oncoming years. And they have chosen Block Solutions to be the, let's say, one of the major suppliers of these blocks into that project. So it's really about building standalone homes, high-rise buildings, and there are so many ideas coming from different engineers all over the world where the Block Solutions can be used. We just need to focus on where to go.
Absolutely. No, I must admit, my this is being from a, obviously, our background, my head is swimming with all the projects that we've got and the ideas. I'm thinking that could save a lot. That could be a lot better. So, yeah. But it's just one of those things.
It's fantastic to see new products in the building market. It really is.
Yeah, it's so conservative, actually. They're not coming up with new ideas. And that's we need to, let's say, it's like combustion engines and so on. We know that there are much better, let's say, solutions available. But is there a will? When there's a will that we can do it. We just need to be, let's say, the pioneers of doing that.
Exactly. Mark, Duncan, what school buildings are on the way now? Where are you working at the moment?
So we just finished building the first one now in June, and that was a 5-classroom school. In fact, the biggest one you guys have built globally, Marcus, that particular school. And so just to give you some context on what our plan is we are ordering more blocks from Finland to build another 2 schools. And we're also building two home concepts. The reason why we're building home concepts is because the earthquakes in Lombok also destroyed 40,000 homes. There's about 20,000 pipeline just on the island of Lombok, let alone Java, Sumatra, the rest of the archipelago. There is at least 10 million worth of low socioeconomic homes that need to be rebuilt. This product's really great from a disaster relief perspective. So we are showing that concept to the government. We've just proven the concept on the school. We're showing the home concept. And then the reason why we're building a few more now is we're trying to build skills and knowledge transfer within the local contractor community in Lombok. It's a really important role that the locals have to play in actually building this. So we decided to bring in the first factory is built in Asia, which will be, we hope, with Marcus early next year. And then we will then be collecting waste and producing the blocks locally in Lombok that will build 200 schools over the next 5 years through Classroom of Hope, through our program. And then we're actually pivoting as an organization as well. We're going to be building homes for families who have lost their homes from the earthquakes. So I know the government's got budgets here to rebuild homes that were destroyed. And, you know, one low socioeconomic home, you can do it in 2 hours and 33 minutes. And the locals can build it themselves, you know. And you start focusing the energies just on village by village by village. And you just, it'll just become self-perpetuating the impact. But the longer term vision for Block Solutions Indonesia is to scale the factories, one factory for Bali, two factories for Java, and one factory, because there is just such a huge amount and supply of plastic waste, and there is such a high demand for building of low socioeconomic homes. So whilst we're doing schools here, the real power product is actually the homes, in my opinion, in this region. Yeah.
Absolutely. And would that then be almost, I know you're doing some disaster relief homes, but that could that also be a profit area that then you can build more schools, help go and build more disaster-led homes and things like that as well?
Yes. Yes, 100%. And, you know, since we launched that video on LinkedIn, the messages all across Indonesia I've been receiving has been huge. I've had developers from all over the world. Yeah, developers who are building high-end homes and villas across Indonesia who now want to build high-end villas using this product. And at the end of the day, this needs to be a commercial social enterprise, right? It's got social impact at the heart of it, but it needs to be profitable for it to be sustainable. And that's a great business model. Yep. And it doesn't matter whether you're building a high-end villa or a school in a disaster-stricken area. To me, environmental impact is environmental impact. So the more the merrier, which is fantastic.
Well, I'm sure we'll be contacting you to talk about some product. Because we've got a lot there. It'd be great to get those blocks in Australia, wouldn't it?
Yeah, indeed. I think it'll be interesting to be able to build here as quick. Things don't get built so quick here. So any method to get
when the
lots of regulation.
Yeah, exactly. Not just that. The current time scale for building a typical 4-bedroom home at the moment is now 3 years.
Wow.
What?
Which is insane.
That's crazy. That's just crazy.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, you can imagine the cost that's associated with that. So for 3 years, you've got a block of land and let's say you paid a mortgage on that block of land and then you're paying fees on the builder for 3 years. It goes up exponentially. So it makes the socioeconomic divide that much greater. So that's a hard thing as well to see. So going back to your projects before I get carried away and start talking too much about what we've got on, you also have, I've seen buildings, is it in Myanmar as well? How has what's currently been going on with the deficit of the elected government, has that caused issues with your projects?
We work with a local partner, Child's Dream, for all our school buildings across Cambodia, Laos, and Myanmar. We have since stopped funding the building of any more schools in Myanmar because the situation became out of control there. It's very high risk in some of those areas. And so until things calm down, we've stepped back. I know our local partners are still doing stuff there, but even after things changed in Myanmar, our local partner was mostly working with the monk monasteries in those rural communities to build, because the education system was not that great with the government. So it's we're on hold at the moment, because it's just last thing we want to do is be putting risk in high risk zones just until things the dust has settled, shall we say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
One of the other things I read, and I'd love to you to give more details, is that apart from building schools, it's not just schools, it's also about education in other ways. Could you highlight some more of the ways you're helping the education of these children?
Certainly. We've had multiple programs. We had a STEM program, Science, Technology, Engineering and Mathematics, where we were providing young women and girls with scholarships to go and study information technology, plant sciences, agriculture. Across girls from Cambodia were going to universities to study in Thailand because they have much better facilities there. So we've done that. We've also developed child-friendly schools, which is an old UNICEF framework, which is more of a holistic approach to the schooling environment in the past. And we've distributed scholarships to at least 1,000 young women, girls and boys as well in rural communities of Cambodia. Our model has somewhat changed, and some of those programs have now discontinued. And the reason why we've done that is because we've learned that being focused works, and simplifying our business model is working really well for us. Mm-hmm. So now we are more focused on building sustainable schools that are safe and secure. So the actual vessel, the schools, and that's our role that we're playing at the moment with our local partners, and doing that really well, especially with the Block Solutions product, rather than taking on too much, which historically we have actually done too much of. So we've kind of looked within and gone, where do we focus? And we are known as a school building organization within the Asia Pacific region. So for us, we're going to do that, and we're going to do it really, really well, and partner with the governments, who in turn will provide the curriculum and the teachers that come into those schools.
So do you have a favorite project or a favorite story from helping the children and building the schools?
I do. We just built this amazing EcoBlock school in Lombok. Do you know what?
Like, if Marcus wasn't on the line, would it be the same project?
Do you know what? I'll be honest with you. I, my wife, myself, our teams, the local partners, we were like pig in mud, just having so much fun with the blocks. It was my daughter was with us, my oldest daughter, she's 4 years old. She was picking them up and stacking them like Lego. It was fun. Everybody was doing it. There wasn't very high risk in the construction environment, which you normally do get with the bricks and mortar because of the weight. And just learning that whole process that Tony from Block Solutions taught us, you know, from getting the leveling right, which is one of the most critical pieces of the entire building. Once you've got that right and you start building it up, when the blocks go up, it's just like that, so quickly. And the locals were just blown away. They were actually in shock. They were like, they can't believe this is a movie. You know, they've never seen anything like this. So to come into a community and build a large structure like that in 5-6 days is just, it's extraordinary. And it really sits close to my heart that project, and how that local community, the kids are in school now in that particular one. I know they got back into school, but I'm hearing they're going to be pulled out of their school now because of the lockdowns that are occurring again. Yeah. So that is my favorite one. I've got lots of favorite stories, many impactful stories of kids. One such story, if you don't mind, I wouldn't mind sharing it. I'm just going to put my part into my life. Is a young boy in Lombok after the earthquakes happened. You know, 500 people died. 90,000 homes destroyed. It was hardcore what happened there. It was a disaster zone. And when I went over as one of the first responders over there to see what happened, there's a young boy who's 13 years old. His whole family's home was flattened. He survived. He's disabled. Prior to the earthquakes, he had a wheelchair, and his wheelchair was destroyed. And we found out that heard about the story about this boy that was dragging his body through the rubble of everything that's been destroyed, 2 kilometers up the road to get to a school that's half destroyed, just so that he could get with his mates in school. And when I heard that story, it like literally brought me to tears, that the spirit of the human being, you know, and how far that kid wants to go just to get some books and to be with his friends and to learn. So we ended up getting him a new bamboo made wheelchair, actually, and taking it to him and delivering it to him. It was a sustainable wheelchair. And seeing his face and that smile and him getting access to education as well is just that's the stuff I just love. And, you know, hearing about the strength of these human beings and what they go through and how resilient they are is incredibly inspirational. So that's one story I love that's close to my heart.
That is kind of answering the next question that we had with regards to the importance of education for these children. Yeah. And why projects like yours are so important.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. Do you know, the power of education, just to give you some statistics, just from Lombok, for example, 50,000 children have been learning in temporary facilities since 2018. A child in a temporary school learns about half as much as what they were in a permanent school. And the loss of learning cost to the Lombok economy is about $72 million per year in future productivity. Every dollar that you invest in education will yield about 15 in return. And this unlocks opportunity, and that's what we want, you know. If you've heard of Project Drawdown, of all the things that you can use, all the initiatives to fight, you know, the climate crisis, number 6 is educating girls, yeah. You know. That is huge, you know. When you start educating young women and girls and giving them education, it is economically proven that they will bring 5 out of poverty with them rather than the guys who will bring out 1 or 2. So you're exponentially increasing the fight against poverty. So, yeah.
Us guys, we're not very good, us guys.
Unless you're inventing blocks.
True, yeah, okay. So how has the pandemic affected you both? So Duncan, you first. How has that affected you? And you said about the kids going back into lockdown, but how has it also affected the building of schools?
So in the countries where we operate with our partners, construction has been seen as essential services. So schools have still been getting built, which has been great. And we're so happy for that, because keeping people in jobs and just ensuring the locals are following the protocols for keeping themselves and their staff safe. But most of the kids in all these countries have been pulled out of school and been learning from home or learning remotely. You know, which isn't easy. And I've had some interesting debates with some people saying, you know, we should just shift all kids into remote learning and this is the future of the world with technology. But I actually disagree with that. I think a school, when you go to Africa and Asia, you know, the school is like the heart of the community. This is where people hang out. This is where social interactions happen. This is where confidence is learned, critical thinking, friendships, you know. So even though, yeah, and I see the value of remote learning, yes, but not as a permanent thing. You know, the school is a beacon of hope in these communities. So I'm glad that we've still been building. And, you know, as and when the pandemic disappears, kids can get back into their schools and back onto their playgrounds and having fun and enjoying the learning experience together.
Absolutely.
And let's not forget the schools sometimes are a safe zone for some of the kids.
Yeah.
It's an escape area.
Absolutely. So, child protection, very important. Yeah, yeah.
So Marcus, how has it affected you and your company and your team?
I remember the date. I was actually supposed to leave back from DRC, so from Kinshasa back to Finland, on the 20th of March. I just had signed on the contract of delivering a factory to Kinshasa to the Ministry of Housing over there. And I got a text message on the 19th of March that the last plane out of Kinshasa is leaving in 3 hours. After that, it's going to be lockdown. I said to the minister, okay, please arrange me of transportation out of the country, please. And it took me about 45 minutes before I was at the airport. had taken all of my stuff from the hotel and so on. Okay, next week, all orders of 7 factories were canceled. Of course, I totally understand that. We're not able to travel to the countries that were supposed to get the factories installed, having the trainings, coming the people coming over to Europe to get the training on how to operate the factories. We just cannot do that. And so, what did we do? We just started further development of the product. That was the only thing that we could do for the, let's say, past, let's say, after that, it was till the almost till the end of the year 2020. But then I said to the guys, hey, come on, it's not going to happen if we're just going to lay on our butts over here. We really need to go forward. And that's when we started to really, with Duncan and so on, to start the restructuring the whole thing. And now actually the interest is so huge that we really still need to be very, very careful on where to travel. Brazil, they have ordered 5 factories to Brazil. We're not going over there because the situation in Brazil is so so severe over there. So I'm not going to put our people into risk, even though it would be, let's say, very important. But you have to take some choices on how to go forward. And but let's say it will become the let's say much better in future.
Yeah. No, we can on a bigger scale as you, but I think when it hit within the first month, I think we lost probably 90%, 95% of our business.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everything got stopped. Everything was put on hold. And it's we hear so many stories of the same kind of thing happening. But things are getting pretty much back to normal now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so too, yeah.
Some
But let's say I just had my 50th coronavirus test last week. So that's just to give you an idea how the COVID has actually have an impact on us.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Duncan, going back to some of the schools, but more specifically some of the children in the schools, could you describe some of the reactions of both the children and the parents and sort of the... When you're going to give them a new school, but then when you're going to open up that school, because it surely must be so heartwarming the day that you suddenly say, gates are open, here's your new school.
It's it's amazing. Hey, it's my wife and my favorite part of the job is when the school's finished and we get to meet the community and see how the community is, how happy they are that when they receive that new school. Every school opening I've been to has just been phenomenal. We like to call it an impact experience. It's a place where your happiness and fulfillment meets at the same time. And especially for our donors, prior to COVID, we bring our donors over to open up the schools and to meet the communities and meet the kids and to get that impact experience so that they may be inspired and want to come back and fund another school in these communities. So to us, we haven't had a negative experience with all the communities we've worked in, and it's always been very touching to see how they react and the gratitude. You just see it on their faces. You know, they don't have much as it is, so to see the big smiles and the big teeth when they're receiving a brand new school and how much pride they've got in their eyes and how proud the teachers are and the local school management and even the governments as well. That to us makes us feel like we've done our job well. And we are also, you know, we like to make them feel like they did it, you know, like there's a lot of wrong development approaches. And, you know, where we are very aligned with Block Solutions is the more locally driven, the better, you know. And when you can make locals feel like they're changing their own country, that is awesome. You know, rather than that Western agency mentality or white savior mentality of us coming over, we know we've got a role to play, and we're providing that role through capital to provide the infrastructure. But the actual people that are implementing those projects are locals, very smart, intelligent men and women that are doing an extraordinary job changing their countries. And what I really love is seeing them see the change they create.
Yeah.
They'll keep on doing it. They'll continue creating.
Yes.
better places and better future.
Yes, exactly.
So from the projects that you've done, and obviously there's lots of them, what would you say some of the key things that you've learned are?
Gosh, there's been so many learnings. In terms of international development models and for ensuring that you are getting the outcomes that you want to achieve with the programs that you're implementing, we've learned that the most important thing is to listen to the locals. And we've done a lot of research into this in understanding what the local requirements are, the locals tell us what those requirements are, and being able to pull a project together that takes those local requirements into account. So we've learned to listen to the locals as best as possible, give or take, bring in external expertise as well for insights and support. The other things that we've learned is that, for schools that we build, there are a lot of volunteers that want to come over and want to build the schools with us. And whilst that is a really great intention and it's good, it can actually be a negative impact as well in these communities, because we're providing jobs and we're trying to ensure that the local micro economies are being supported and that they're actually doing it. So approach is more about creating an impact experience for those donors and seeing the community, seeing the great work they've done, rather than actually coming up there and picking up hammers themselves or putting blocks. And, it's a catch-22, because we did also just help build some blocks now over the last week, but that was the first one. Our goal is to have the locals building this all across Indonesia and them building their own homes and their own schools. So, so many learnings. Fundraising is a whole chapter I can talk about all night.
Well, we'll perhaps talk to you about that somewhere else and another time.
No worries.
We're actually just asking, what does Classroom of Hope need to continue the success story? So I'm assuming fundraising and funds is one of the most important.
Yeah, perfecting our business model and our partnerships and working with the right organizations and a good team that is focused on our mission. To us, our organization is just a group of great people trying to implement. And the success is those human beings that are working in our organization and our partner organizations. They are the ones that are making this happen collectively together. But I would also say that the success is also reliant on us forming strategic partners for fundraising. So at the moment, for this major program of 200 schools, we're in talks with the Australian government, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade through the embassy, as well as also talking to some of the Scandinavian governments through their development budgets. So that's where Marcus and I are looking at doing presentations together, one on the program and two on the product, and how this can create significant change in Indonesia and then access those aid and development budgets to implement it.
If people from our audience are interested in helping, how can they help?
Firstly, awareness is so important. So we've got an EcoBlocks page on our website that showcases the product, explains information. There's some great fact sheets and economic reports and videos. Share that as far and wide as possible. The more people know about this resilient product and how we're doing things differently with building schools and also building homes, the better. If people would like to donate, they can obviously go to the website and make a donation, and their money is tagged towards the EcoBlocks schools. And everybody who donates, doesn't matter if it's $1 or $100,000, everybody receives an impact report with GPS coordinates and photos and videos to showcase with transparency exactly where the money is being spent and the impact being created.
Absolutely. Well, we'll put a link to the websites on our show notes. But just for those that are listening and not going through show notes, what's the website address?
It is www.classroomofhope.org.
Fantastic. And Marcus, do you want to let us know your website link?
So it's blocksolutions.com. There's a dash between over there, but blocks-solutions.com.
Fantastic. Well, we'll put those on the show notes.
Wonderful.
Thank you. And share us far and wide. All the places that you both have worked, did you see any areas significantly affected and impacted by climate change?
Uganda. That's what I can say. There, it's like Lake Victoria, for example. The level of the lake has risen with 1 meter, so there's no shorelines left over there, and that's really, it's like they couldn't understand what's happening. So that's really something very, very strange. But actually, the biggest changes that we are really seeing of the climate change is actually in the polar areas, like close to where we live.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah, for me, it's thinking about it, I've spent a lot of time in Indonesia. It's been Indonesia. I'm a diver as well. So what's going on underwater is extraordinary at the moment across the globe with all the, the coral that's bleaching and aqualife that's dying at a rapid pace, you know, where we get 70% of our oxygen coming from this life underwater. And diving through the archipelago, I can see things diminishing very quickly and temperatures are rising in the oceans. And it's the rising of those temperatures that are causing that. So I've also noticed since being here over the last 5 years, there is a shift in the seasons that are going on. You know, the wet season's coming a lot later and monsoons are changing. So there's definitely something that's going on. And we've certainly picked up on it and in the expat community over here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite hard. I mean, we were speaking to Hoyas. He directed
The Cove
Game Changers and Embracing Extinction. Mm. And he was saying about him and his friend that went diving, and they're avid divers, and they went back to a place they went 10 years ago because it was so great. They've got to go back to the same coordinates. And they dived down, and it was gone. There was no reef there, completely missing. And it's just horrendous how many times we're hearing this sort of scenario over and over again.
Yeah, it's concerning.
But still, there are people who are really saying that there is no climate change, and that's really mind-boggling. I really can't understand that.
It is. Sometimes I get very, very angry about it. Sometimes I'm just in complete dismay.
Part of our interviews were inviting climate scientists to go through what the climate community is actually believing and where they are with this. We passed this, whether there is climate change or not. It's how to fix it now, really. They've completely gone past that.
And are we able to fix it? That's also a big question.
Yeah. In time.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So moving on then, and to change it from what could be quite a depressing note as that was, aspects to make you optimistic for the future. Marcus, we'll go to you first and then Duncan after.
Sure. What would make me optimistic is involving the local community to get them to collect the waste plastics from the nature, from the seashores, to bring them to our factories in Lombok, to start the production over there. And maybe these, for example, these big companies like Coca-Cola Company, Pepsi-Cola Company, could actually participate in this. They would, for example, put some waste baskets for people to throw the plastic bottles into those waste baskets that Duncan and his crew could then go and pick up, shred it, wash it, pelletize it, and then produce affordable houses for people. That would make me, let's say, happy and enthusiastic about the future, because then we're involving the local communities, and that's a game-changing thing. But if people don't really see the point of doing something, then why should we? But that's what I want to make the change. Maybe actually the companies like these major corporate structures, they could pay even the people for bringing the plastics in. Because if the governments will say that plastics, they're going to ban the plastic bottles because you're not doing anything. They have huge CSR policies in these companies. So let's make something good out of it. That's mine.
Yeah.
Duncan, what would be your view of what would make you optimistic for the future?
Children have me hugely optimistic about the future. I look at young girls like Malala Yousafzai. I look at Greta, and I see these youth that are standing up and not putting up with the ineptness of what's going on in the world, and how us adults and, you know, even at the UN and everything, we're trying to resolve these issues, but we just can't seem to get it right. So to me, I have high hopes for the youth of the world and the kids that are coming through and the education they're receiving and the green leaders that are coming through that are showing huge inspiration and pulling movements together to create change for our planet. So I'm excited about them because I believe they're the ones that are going to really change our world. And hopefully my daughter and my daughters have a beautiful planet moving forward. I always worry as a father for what the future lies ahead for them, you know, and the youth and kids, I've got high hopes for them.
Absolutely. No, I completely agree. I think that's probably one of my key points too.
And they really need to get the education. Because, for example, when you're traveling in Africa, if they don't know anything about it, and they're just struggling to get the daily bread for the people, and we need to give them viable options to do something good for themselves. And then it will gradually change.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what question, and we asked this to everybody, just in case, what question should we have asked but didn't? It's a catch-all, isn't it? It's so good.
Me, I'm just trying to think. I can't actually think, to be honest. I think you guys have nailed quite a lot of good questions there and covered off a lot of things. Off the top of my head, I'm sorry, I can't think of anything you haven't asked that I think has been valuable. I think most of the questions have been really good ones.
Thank you.
It's all good, thank you.
Yeah.
Marcus?
How should we involve the big corporates to participate in the fighting about the plastic waste? That is one of the things that I really would need to have, so that have them, that they would really be interested in the whole thing. Because it's such a waste that we're doing it. Let's say, I have to say about this situation in Ghana, in Accra. I went to the shoreline over there, and there were a bunch of, let's say, fishers going out to the sea. And when they came back, they had a very big catch of about 270 kilograms in the nets. Not one single fish, only plastic bottles in the nets. Not one single fish. And those are the things that we should start thinking about. The people are not catching any fish anymore. They're catching more plastic bottles over there. So that should be a wake-up call for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
It would be good if we can push more policy-led direction to larger corporations that aren't being taxed in any way for the amount of pollution that they cause.
Yeah.
But it's really also about giving viable options to those different companies. If they have options, maybe they will choose the better option at that point. And then they can have the green flag over there.
Yeah. Well, the green flag is kind of a token gesture. What we actually want to do is find them a commercially viable option where they actually want to do it.
So we don't want to take any more of your time. We had one more question that we ask usually to just carry on that advice from every single of our guests to our audience. If you were to ask our audience to change one thing to save our planet, what would that be? How can it be good? Duncan,
you're under the bus.
Okay, let me have a think about this one. You know what? My choice would be eat sustainably. You know, food production is just such a major driver of wildlife extinction, and what we eat contributes, I think, to around about a quarter of global greenhouse gas emissions. So I'm not saying everybody should go vegan or vegetarian or anything like that. I would say for me, for example, I quit beef 5 years ago. I watched Cowspiracy and I quit and I said that's going to be my impact. And I haven't had it since then. I'm not saying everybody has to do that, but try something like halve your meat consumption, you know, and create a more balanced meal. Because if you just halved it, and if you exponentially had, you know, millions of people doing that across the globe, it will have a huge impact. So eating sustainably, I think, is something simple that we can do to impact our day-to-day lives and how we're impacting the planet.
Absolutely.
Indeed, yeah. It's something that we can all do. There's no restrictions on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, mine is actually think before consuming. Whatever that means for everybody, that's the point, that don't make any harsh, let's say, decisions, just like what your feelings are. Think before consuming.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very, very much. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've got so many things going around in my head right now, but we'll have to talk about that another time. It would be a delight to be able to catch up with you guys again in the future as you're looking at new projects, bigger projects, all the things that you're doing. It's something that I think would be of value to our listeners and selfishly us as well.
Okay, wonderful.
That's great. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure.
So that was Duncan Ward and Marcus Silverberg, and it was a delight to be able to talk to them. So passionate about what they do, what they're trying to achieve, about the kids. I loved the idea that Duncan was talking about. Not the idea, the fact that all the kids are so delighted and so want to be there, and it's creating more than just a school. It's a community, a place of hope and salvage and respite as well. There's a lot more to it than, I don't want to say just a school because it's a big feat, but there's a lot more to it than schools alone.
Yeah, I think, and just giving the community the opportunity to actually build the school themselves, get them involved in every single part of the project is so important, because they'll carry that through and they'll understand how important they are for the future in building their own community. So yeah, giving them the tools to rebuild their communities, it's an important step.
And they take ownership of it as well.
And I have to say, I'm really impressed with the Block Solutions. Their product's amazing, really, really amazing. And we already thought about so many areas that it can be used and where we'd like to see it. So if you'd like to donate, please go to classroomofhope.org to help this amazing initiative. And we'll put all the information on the show notes as well. If you're in the industry and you're building in Africa or in Asia or anywhere else, go to blocksolutions.com and check out their products. It's really incredible.
Absolutely. So as usual, follow, like, share, subscribe, wherever the button is on YouTube. I never really know where it is along this line. And we hope to hear from you soon. And take care. See ya.
Bye. Bye-bye.